For the price of a magazine, subscribe to The Guitar Channel to access the full videos.
Yeah.
All right, excellent. Welcome to the Guitar Channel. I am super happy to welcome you a new interview. I have on the other side of the Zoom connection, the one and only Corey Wong. Corey, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I'm great. I mean, it's really such a pleasure to do this interview with you. You know, it's kind of funny because I am a huge fan of your music, but also of your podcast. So I heard so many podcasts with you, you know, talking with incredible guitar players in my head that it feels that I am a good friend with you. But it's the first time you see me. Anyway, I'm very happy to do that with you, Corey. Tell me, what was your very first guitar?
My very first guitar was a Gretsch Traveling Wilburys thing that I bought at a pawn shop for like $40 or something. Very bad condition. It's normally a decent guitar, but the one that I had just was in bad condition.
It's a guitar and with one pickup, right?
I think so, yeah. Mm-hmm. I had it for a few weeks, and after a few weeks of playing guitar, me and my family realized that it was something that I was very passionate about and that I was very driven to learn. So I got a Fender Stratocaster.
Cool. And do you remember the very first thing you were able to play on the guitar?
I think the first thing I ever played was... I think that was probably the first. And then I like played it on all the
Yeah, right. You have to.
Yeah. I think that was the first thing I ever played on guitar.
And yeah. What was the initial inspiration to pick up the guitar? So you just mentioned that you started very early on. So did you add a big brother or inspiration that really drove you to learn to play the guitar?
It was a combination of probably... Sorry, I'm going to adjust this a little bit. A combination of the Red Hot Chili Peppers, Green Day, Nirvana, and the Foo Fighters, and Weezer. That's kind of what really got me wanting to play guitar at first. And, you know, really, actually, I started on the bass because I liked the bass a lot. I was also huge into Primus. But between Primus and Red Hot Chili Peppers, I wanted to be a bass player. And then eventually I moved over and started playing guitar.
And what was your training? Did you learn to play the instrument by yourself? Did you add some teachers, mentors, things like that?
At first, it was a lot of reading guitar tabs from the internet and trying to train my ears to learn things by ear. And then I got a guitar teacher after a while. After about 4 months, I ran into some roadblocks and decided that I needed a teacher. And I started getting lessons once a week. And I did that for a few years. And all the way, actually, yeah, most of the way through high school as well. And, but it was a lot of just reading guitar books, guitar tab books, guitar tabs online. And I was in the school band, so learning how to read sheet music. I played guitar in the jazz band in school, so I was learning how to play, you know, the all the jazz repertoire and that sort of thing. And then I went to college for music. So then I really took it seriously. I went to a music school and I had a mentor there and had really great teachers. And yeah, that's really where it took off, because that then I had a real structured way to learn the instrument.
And at what point did you realize that your Your calling would be to play funk guitar rather than, I don't know, blues rock or whatever, or you know, the Red Hot Chili Peppers stuff and Nirvana and stuff like that.
As far as the type of music I play now, I don't think there was a specific, there wasn't a specific moment where that really hit for me. It was more about, when did I realize that music was really my calling in life? That to me was when I was probably 20.
Okay.
Realized that music is the thing that I should do with my life. This is what I'm meant to do. And from there, it was playing a whole variety of different things and different types of bands. And actually, more recently, the type of guitar style that I have now, I probably didn't fall into until maybe 5, 6 years ago, something like that. Yeah.
And who would you say are the main influences in your guitar playing?
In the way that I play guitar, probably a combination of Prince, Pat Metheny, John Scofield, James Valentine, John Mayer, John Frusciante, Al McKay from Earth, Wind & Fire, Dave Williams, the stuff that he played with Michael Jackson, Paul Jackson Jr., Nile Rodgers to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, those are probably the biggest ones for me.
And do you remember what was the... how did you structure your work to increase step by step the level on the guitar to where you are at the moment, you know, where you are in the very short, very small club of world-class guitar players?
Well, thank you for saying that. I think it's a combination of... When I was in college, I practiced a lot. I was probably 8 hours a day.
Okay.
Now, I don't think that everybody needs to practice that much, and I certainly don't practice that much nowadays. But to me, it's more about having a specific vision in mind, specific goals in mind, and having a practice regimen that's going to get you there as far as, okay, today I'm playing, you know, today I can play... But I want to get to, or whatever, you know, it's like, okay, I want to bump it up by 6 BPM or whatever your goal is, you know, just setting that and being able to, you know, in the same way that people that train fitness, you know, and physical trainers will train an athlete and put them on a specific routine and have checkpoints along the way and track their progress. To me, that's what I did, is I tracked my progress through keeping track of BPMs, keeping track of, you know, what my goals are, what my checkpoints are. I mean, I literally have all kinds of books here that, you know, like that I've gone through. These are just like this Ted Green chord book, another Ted Green chord chemistry book, this Mick Goodrick Advancing Guitarist book.
Aha, that's the secret then. Okay. So if we buy those three books,
we can become
the next Corey Wong. Okay, that's the secret.
No, it's a combination of, you know, it's that sort of thing. It's, okay, here's these books. And, you know, there's a lot of other stuff. I have a whole bookshelf in the other room.
Mm-hmm.
It's 100 books of things that I've gone through. And just continuing to find ways to explore. So to me, there's several different things. There's the brain side, and then there's the hands side of guitar playing.
Mm-hmm.
And when it comes to hearing or reading something on the guitar, is the disconnect between what I'm seeing on the page or what I'm hearing on the radio, is the disconnect between there to my brain, or is the disconnect between my brain to my hands?
Mm-hmm.
And I separate those things. So when I read a certain passage of music, do I know the notes and rhythms and how they go?
If so, great. Now, do I know where they lay on the guitar? Because those are two different things. So if somebody who's not good at sight reading, are they not good at reading the notes? Are they not good at placing those notes on the instrument? Because those are two separate things to practice. Now, as far as how you practice your rhythm and your timing, are you hearing time accurately? And are you actually hearing when things are rushing or dragging or right on the beat? That's the brain side of things, your awareness. Or is the disconnect not being able to execute it on your instrument? Are you... like, how consistent are you able to make whatever it is that you're playing? Or as far as... is the disconnect your brain being able to see or hear that sort of thing? Or is the disconnect in your hands not being able to do it? And the same thing goes for playing patterns. So if I'm trying to do this accent pattern of... my pick kind of slipped in my hand there for a second. So there was one little spot in there where it got inconsistent. But I heard that and I know that and I felt that. So that's okay. You learn to adjust and keep plugging along. So, you know, for somebody to analyze their own playing, that's also, you just have to be honest with yourself. Do I understand the brain side of things? Do I understand brain and awareness side of things? And can I actually do the execution side of things? You have to really analyze yourself, listen back to things, and then just make notes on, I was trying to transcribe the solo, but it was really hard for me to do. Was it hard to transcribe the solo because you couldn't hear it? Or was it hard to transcribe the solo because it was hard to play?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Those are two different things. So I think part of my practice routine and what I think a lot of people who have become world-class musicians do is they separate stuff as much as possible to really get to the root of what it is that's the issue.
Mm-hmm. And specifically on your right hand playing, on your rhythm playing, how did you practice that? Because you just did a short demonstration and it's really laser focused and the groove is there in the pocket and so on. So did you use a lot of the metronome and increase the BPM beat by beat? Or did you play a lot with a drummer or with loops? Because it seems that it's so difficult to really practice that and to make progress, to quantify that kind of progress. So what's the secret to make a big progress in that area?
Well, the secret is to just tell yourself that it's not hard.
Okay.
And just do exactly what you're talking about. I mean, that's very simply put. Play along with a drum loop, play along with a metronome, okay. Play along with a great drummer. Yeah, do that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the hard thing is just to actually do it and to sit back and analyze yourself, to put on a metronome and to be able to look at, you can nowadays, it's so easy. Just open up whatever DAW you use and record yourself playing.
Mm. Okay.
Am I ahead of the beat or am I behind it? Or am I right on it? What's my natural tendency? And for most people, it's that they rush.
Mm-hmm.
Most people rush things, but I think the more you can control that and the more you can be aware of it, okay, I'm rushing. Let me just tweak myself a little bit behind. And it might feel a little uncomfortable, but there's so minute changes that eventually when you get, like, I still work on my time every day. So yes, it's practicing with a metronome, getting the place where your brain consistency and your execution consistency is right there and can see it. For me, I visualize the grid as it goes by. And then the other part of that is, how does something groove? It doesn't always groove when you're, that's not always, you know, like, you wanted me to stop doing that about a third of the way through that I was doing that. And
right.
So did I, right? Okay, but I take the same chord, the same strumming pattern and go. And that's very much a grid approach to playing. And it's, but it's adding the nuance of the, so it's, there's that little breath that feels like it's in there within the, you know, so there's kind of two grooves happening within that. And I think that's where the misconception of if something is exactly in time that it doesn't groove, to me that's wrong. As long as there's some sort of breath and some sort of bump happening, something groove really hard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and as long as you put that sort of thing in there, and of course there's a little bit of human error in there, and I'm not perfectly in time, but if I strive for that and I let the groove come from the nuances of how I play, that's fine. And then sometimes you lay something back. You know, and then you kind of have to make up for it again. So it kind of pulls back and then you get up. There's that sort of thing that happens, which can create a fun push-pull in the time and the feel, and it adds a certain level of groove, but you have to be aware of that. You have to hear that, and you have to be able to execute that. So what I always liken it to is like shooting darts, like playing right on the grid. You're just aiming for bullseyes every time. But if you practice shooting at 17s, you'll hit 17s. But you have to know that that's what you're going for, mm-hmm. and you have to be able to execute that. Hitting bullseyes is different than hitting triple 20s. Hitting bullseyes is different than hitting a double 18 on a dartboard. So both are great, but it's just what are you actually, you have to know what and why you're going for, and then you have to be able to actually do it.
Excellent. Tell me a little bit more about your... the start of the adventure with Wolfpack and Fearless Flyers.
So I first met the guys in Wolfpack when they, some of the, I think it was Theo, Jack, Joe, and Joey were coming into town, into Minneapolis, where I live. And we have some mutual friends. They were coming through town on tour with playing for another artist. And we had some mutual friends. They said, go see Corey's band. They're great, blah, 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 this and that. They came out to the gig. We met afterwards, hung out, became friends, went to breakfast the next day. I was traveling a lot to Los Angeles at the time for work. And we were just hanging out a lot as friends. And then eventually started playing, you know, jamming a little bit together. And then Jack just kind of absorbed me into the band. And then he had a vision for this band, the Fearless Flyers, kind of an offshoot of Wolfpack. You know, and his vision was three guitars on stands, bass, Barry, and electric, Nate Smith on kick, snare, hat. That's the band.
Okay.
And he said, who's the Barry guitar player? I said, well, because he said, I know it's you and Dart, and Nate Smith is the centerpiece of the band. Who do we get to play Barry? And at the time, Mark Lethierry started doing Baritone Funk Thursdays or something on his Instagram. And I'd been aware of Mark and a fan of Mark's for a while. So I just hit him up and was like, hey, we've got this idea for a band. You down? He's like, totally, I'm in. So the first time that we met Mark or Nate was on the first day of sessions for the Fearless Flyers album.
Wow, cool.
Yeah. Yeah, it was fun. And we all stayed together. Well, no, that's a lie. The night before, we all went over to Jack's and had dinner. And Joe, Mark, Nate, and myself all stayed in the same Airbnb together. So we were living in a house together for 4 days or something. And yeah, it was great.
It's really special for me to do this interview with you because a couple of weeks ago now, I had the opportunity to do a second interview with Marc Lethierry because he has just released a new album with all this baritone craziness, funk music and everything. And it's really amazing to see a young musician making it in the business in this kind of playing. And I mean, I'm old enough that I went through, you know, the big shred area era, I mean, with the Joe Satriani, the Steve Vai, and it seems that now the shredder of 2021 are guys like you or like Mark, and like just a strat, a compressor, and being a right a DI into the console, and here we go, let's groove, rule the world like that. How do you feel about that?
That would be a lot of pressure to put on me, but I'm good for it. Because it's just doing what I do. Mm-hmm. If you ask me to play like Vai or Satriani, I can't do it. And they would probably say the same thing about playing like Mark or myself. You know, we're just completely different styles. And that's totally cool. And that's what actually what's really fun about the guitar and art in general is, you know, you're not going to ask Picasso to make a Dali painting, and you're not going to ask Dali to make a Monet. Mm-hmm. And we all have our preferences. My favorite painter is Monet, and we all have our favorite albums. My favorite series of his is all the stuff from Giverny and the gardens and all of that, which actually I went there.
Right.
I was able to visit, which
nice
was
place.
Amazing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Incredible. It's some of the most inspiring art to me, both in the fact that, you know, he designed the gardens and that he just painted the gardens for years. But anyways, you know, we're all different painters on our instruments and we all paint differently. And what people celebrate in a certain era is different. And I think, the average person still looks at like that shredding guitar, and that on that like is much more overtly like, whoa. But the rhythm guitar hero, which is like my area of mm-hmm. expertise, it's much more covert in its wow factor.
Yeah.
Of course, there's certain things that are, you know, much more obvious, but it's a totally different game. It's a totally different thing. And I'm cool with that. I love that. And to be considered one of the guitar heroes of today would be a true honor. Mm-hmm. And I would lock arm in arm with Mark going into any battle, any guitar battle of such, because Mark is amazing. He's awesome. Actually, if you look behind me, this is the baritone guitar. This is my baritone guitar. The first Fearless Flyers album, Mark was saying, hey, I'm going to be coming from another tour. I'm not going to have a Barry. Do you have one that you could bring to the session? So he actually played my baritone guitar for the first Fearless Flyers album.
Okay, excellent.
And this Barry is this guy Bacci, Bruno Bacci, and it's in Italy. He builds these guitars and Mark fell in love with it. And I was like, all right, we need Bruno to make you one. So he connected with Bruno and Bruno made him one. It was great. Yeah.
Yeah. I think when I did the interview with Mark, he went through a couple of guitars and he showed one of this instrument. Yeah. Pretty cool. Let's talk about, your latest album is called Corey and the Wong Note. So can you tell us about how you approach composition? Because it is both a joy to listen to, and it can be also very complex because there can be a lot of change. So how do you compose a song, basically?
Well, for that particular project, it was a concept of, I wanted to record the album live on a TV set, like a variety show. And I wanted a large band, so it's an 11-piece band, guitar, bass, drums, keyboards, and percussion. So that's 5-piece rhythm section, and then 6 horns, 2 trumpets, trombone, 3 saxes, and occasional guests as well. So with that particular album, I wanted to create something for that specific band, that setup. And when I was writing, the writing process was the same as any other, but where sometimes I would have some lead guitar lines, give them to the horns.
Okay.
To give the horns something exciting to play. Sometimes trading off the focus of the tune from being a guitar thing, being a sax thing or a brass thing. You know, so in that album, it was fun to be able to write for different things. And to me, I don't always love playing the melody on guitar. I don't always love being the main focused melody. Because honestly, even for myself as a listener, sometimes it's like, all right, I get it. I've had enough guitar. I want to hear something else. You know, or I don't need to hear. Whatever, just like some melodic thing like that. Sometimes I just want to hear. And sometimes that's just what I want to play or whatever, right? So I go back and forth between the guitar being the melody or the horns. And I love playing rhythm guitar. So my approach to writing on that was, I'm just going to write the tunes and then I'm going to, however they come out. And then I'm going to arrange them for the specific band. And some things felt like, oh, this makes more sense for the horn section to be the melodies. Other times it made more sense for me to. Or whatever, mm-hmm. You know, like as far as me playing the melody. And then give the solo to somebody else, or, you know, I play the melody and a horn player does the solo, or the horns do the melody, but I play the solo. In a similar way where it's like, you don't hear Slash playing the verse melody on Guns N' Roses songs. He plays the guitar solo and the rhythm, you know, and he plays the guitar parts. So a lot of times I approach my playing that way, where a lot of guitar albums, it's just, so much guitar. Guitar here, guitar there, guitar here. Ooh, guitar melody.
Ooh, wait. Yeah.
Four guitars playing chorus melody. And also, like, to me, I go, oh my gosh, I just need a break from that. I just need a break, you know? And that's okay with me. And a lot of my approach to playing guitar as well is like getting a good piano sound. When you listen to Keith Jarrett play, he's not playing through a bunch of pedals and whatever. He's just, it's a piano sound. Brad Meldow, he sits down at the piano and it's the piano. So for me, with my clean guitar sound, a lot of the times I'm thinking like that, where, okay, what can I get away with by just sitting down at the piano? And by piano, I mean just clean acoustic or clean electric guitar, right? So, finding good tones. And of course my pickup selector can help a little bit, but, you know, and I use pedals for a lot of stuff, but it's a fun challenge sometimes to just keep it clean and see what kind of interesting things I can make happen just by the playing and the tones, and even just picking differently. If I go, or you know, they're all different ways to do kind of the same part without any effects, but there's different effect involved because of the pick or whatever, you know, or mm-hmm. pickup selector
and
harmony.
And regarding gear on this album, I mean, your guitar sound is really glorious. How did you record it? Was it that Strat, a compressor, and straight to the console, or what did you use?
This is my Strat directly into the Archetype Cory Wong plugin.
Okay.
The Neural DSP plugin.
Okay.
Yep. And actually, for my last few albums, that's all that I've used.
Mm-hmm. To prepare this interview, I went also through a great album you released also in 2020 called Trail Songs Dawn. And to tell you the truth, I really discovered your acoustic guitar playing in that record. And I would like to know how you approach acoustic guitar playing compared to electric guitar, because it's still very recognizable that we recognize your style in that album, but it is you're not, you know, mimicking okay yeah, I know how to play electric guitar, let's do the same thing on acoustic. You have a completely different way to play. So how do you approach acoustic guitar to electric compared to what you do in electric?
Now my approach to it is different, partially because, I mean, this sounds absurd to say, but I'm listening to what the guitar sounds like while I'm playing it.
Sound good. Yeah.
Yeah. Imagine that. The guitar is, to me, it's, so my voice is my voice. And what I feel like is musically appropriate is what I'm going to play. And what my ears tell me is appropriate and the right thing to play for a given song is still, it's what I hear when I play electric guitar, or if I play acoustic guitar, or if I'm sitting down playing, or if I'm playing bass. What does my ear say is appropriate? My taste. What does my taste say needs to happen here? And what is my given instrument in my hands at the time? Now, each instrument has its own strengths, and I just tried to rely a little more on what are the strengths of the acoustic guitar and what is my voice on the instrument, my voice as an artist, how can I represent that and explore that through that instrument. So, of course, it sounds like me because it's me, and I have my fingerprint on it, but it's different because the music was calling for something different. The instrument felt like it was calling for something different. And even though I play some of the same sort of lines that I would on electric guitar, some of the same sorts of rhythms, even the way I attack it, the way that I approach it, the way that I use my voicings, the resonance of the instrument, it's different than the electric guitar. So I'm adjusting to the guitar, and my taste is adjusting along with it. So knowing that I have an acoustic guitar, naturally I'm going to play a little bit differently.
Mm-hmm. I think you are supposed to come to play in France in October. So let's cross finger and hope that it will actually happen. So do you know with who are the musicians you are going to come with, or will it be just you by yourself? Tell us.
It'll be the full band.
All right, cool.
It's going to be great. Yeah, I'm really excited. I love doing the full band tour. It's a lot of people to travel, but it's worth it to me. Mm-hmm. It's fun.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it's just a much more exciting show that way. I like being an entertainer, putting on a good show. In a live show, I explore a little more guitar-wise. I do have more effects. I play more guitar solos, and that's fun. But there's also, the band is so energetic. There's so much. It's really fun. It's incredible. I can't wait to get back out.
Yeah. Hopefully we'll be able to see each other when you are in France. And maybe you can come here to my showroom in Paris and we'll do another Guitar in Hand interview.
Love that.
Yeah. As a word of conclusion, what would be the word of wisdom you would like to share with musicians, watching this or hearing that through the podcast?
Well, I think because this is a guitar channel, I'll speak to guitar players. I think, well, there's two sides of it, is your actual playing the instrument, and then there's your actual artistry and creativity. Like I mentioned earlier, in your practicing of the craft of the guitar, focus on, separate things between your ears and your brain and your awareness of what you hear to what you know in your head, or what you see and what you know in your head. That's one thing. And then what you're able to execute on the instrument is another. Separate those things and work on whichever wherever there's a misfire, wherever there's a disconnect, figure that out and really learn the craft of what you're doing. So that way, artistically, if you're trying to accomplish something, your technical facility, your knowledge of the fretboard is not going to get in the way. If you want to play a C major triad in three octaves, it shouldn't be any issue for you to play it, or even a major seven. Sorry. I wouldn't do it normally like that, but yeah, you get what I'm saying. It's if you're hearing a major seven arpeggio, and then it lands up on a non-chord tone,
yeah,
are you able to execute that? And is that something you actually hear? And then you just practice that. I am not giving you a great example right now. I haven't warmed up and I'm not really, I'm just kind of thinking and talking at the same time and playing. But that's that sort of thing. And then as far as the artistry and creativity side, find what it is that you want to say with your life and something that means something to you. Do you want to share peace with the world? Do you connect right now with a message of social justice issues? Let that be your guiding light in the type of music that you make and the type of music you play. And I say this all the time. If you connect yourself to something bigger than yourself, with a larger purpose than just, look at what I can play on the guitar. Ooh, like, whatever. Whatever. That's, who cares if you can play fast? I don't know. It's cool and it's fun, but do you have something meaningful to say? And do you have a meaningful way to say it? I think that's what's really important. And that's what a lot of people lose sight of when they spend all the hours in the shed practicing. And of course, you need to do that so your artistic vision can be brought to life in a way that's not hindered by what you're able to do on the instrument.
Excellent. Did you learn anything special when you did all the great interviews we mentioned at the beginning of the podcast? You know, I have to congratulate you on this podcast, because not only you are a great musician, but you are a superb interviewer. So I enjoyed a lot the interviews you did with John Scofield and people like that. So did you learn anything by talking with those incredible guitar players?
Yeah, I've learned a lot. And most of it has to do with just reiterating the point of finding something unique about yourself and hearing different people's version of what that is, how they've found a way to stand out in a world of thousands and thousands of guitar players. It's the same thing that many of us are trying to figure out. And any person who's trying to, young person who's trying to play guitar now, how do I stand out? How do I get attention for what I do amongst the sea of other amazing guitar players out there? And understanding what it is, what's special about you, something compelling about you. And normally that is you. It's not, can I play this really fast thing? Of course, that sometimes has to do with that, and that's a part of what I do as well, but it's more about finding your own unique voice on the instrument and your own unique compelling thing to say with your artistry. And interviewing a lot of these musicians, whether it be Vince Gill or Joe Satriani or John Scofield or whoever, you know, these giants of the guitar, you know, they've put in the time on their instrument, but they've also put in the time finding something compelling and unique to say in their own way. And hearing each person's story on how they've done that or how they got around to that is really, to me, what I've learned a lot from.
Mm-hmm. All right. Again, thank you very much for your time, Corey. It was great to be able to have you. And hopefully next time we'll meet face to face. So thank you very much. And congratulations for the podcast, for all the music for you produce. And hopefully we'll be able to get back on the road very, very quickly. Thank you again very much for your time.
Yes, thank you. Hopefully see you soon.
Bye-bye.
Peace.
For the price of a magazine, subscribe to The Guitar Channel to access the full videos.